I am a non-academic community psychologist and evaluation consultant. I help communities address the harm done by sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking. So I'm here in part to talk about this work that I've done with PCAR and Penn State, and I'm going to draw on those experiences, but also from pulling from various literatures to kind of integrate everything that we've talked about with some big picture concepts. And if I could really go back and tie in what everybody has said for the past 2 days that really fits this metaphor that I'm about to build, I would really go over the time that's been allotted. So I'm not adjusting my prepared remarks to account for all these connections, and I will just encourage and challenge you to make the connections between what I'm saying here now and what we've already heard. So honestly, I'm truly humbled to be here at all, and I'm kind of honored that Doug gave the honor of the closing speaker, the last word here, to a feminist social change advocate. So that sort of feels like a coup to me. And I'm going to use my time today to build this metaphor of meeting at the midway for understanding practice-based evidence. And I'm just briefly going to introduce this notion and the relevance of a couple other topics, if I can, to this work. So it's just an introduction. If I do anything right here today, you can go home and do lots of Googling on some of these topics. So for a long time, I have thought about the work that I do and talked about the work that I do as bridging the gap between research and action. So how many people here recognize that language? And let's take this opportunity for a big arm stretch, right? Raise your hand if you have a general sense of what is going on when I say bridging the gap. Thank you. You are an active audience. It's pretty accessible language, right? It has a powerful visual metaphor. You see it on all kinds of conference titles. It happens to be the title of a talk that I was going to try to fit in later. We'll see if I get there, a journal article that's been really useful to me in my work. And it's effective language, right, because it's a very visual metaphor. So in terms of brain processing, it's this simple linear image that allows us to chunk large amounts of information that we code as research over here on one side, and large amounts of information and experiences that we code as practice on this other side. And this metaphor allows us to visually define this problem and then visually define the solution. And it's a solution that connects these two concepts. And as you probably know, a sense of connection is really huge to most of us on this planet. So the other reason that bridging the gap is language that works really well is because it's pretty visceral. You have a feeling when you're on a bridge. It's a feeling driven by the height of where you're at and the view that you can see from up there. And finally, the notion of a bridge is really useful, right? It's purposeful. It activates our resourcefulness, the inner engineer in all of us. And bridges exemplify that human ability to use ingenuity to build solutions where we perceive problems. And one of the best bridges that we've talked a lot about is between research and practice is this notion of evidence-based practice, developing solutions that are theoretically driven, field-tested, supported by empirical results of well-designed studies. And so now I've now spent 3+ years practicing outside of academia, working with organizations to help them become theory-driven and outcome-focused, to begin to have them think about their work as for impact rather than nonprofit. And the farther I move away from the world of research and science, which, if nothing else, today has convinced me how much I very, very value, how very highly I value that, I see that this metaphor is actually a bit more relevant to people in the research world than anywhere else. So my charge today was to talk about practice-based evidence. And when I thought about this talk, I thought, well, maybe I'll emphasize the reciprocity between these ideas, the contributions these two communities offer, how it's iterative and cyclical and synergistic, and I made some drawings of a two-way street before I kind of took a breath and then erased some of that. because the endeavor of generating practice-based evidence in the field in collaboration with others has introduced me firsthand and repeatedly to the idea of complexity. So a bit of historical context, and I'm going to do this quickly, but we've got this age of democratized and digitalized information, right? We've got higher education levels. We need higher education levels. Most communities in our, or many communities in our country have access to the internet and all these mobile devices to tap into it. People want data they can see and touch, and pretty quickly, right? So this term of practice-based evidence is kind of gaining traction in the field. And again, just out of curiosity, how many people have heard this term? Practice-based evidence. Okay, so it's getting there. And a big piece of what's behind this shift is the idea that future prevention solutions to child sexual abuse should incorporate and legitimate community-supported strategies and culturally relevant innovation in addition to or alongside of evidence-based practice. There's no agreed upon articulation. This is still under construction, but I want to take a look at some of what people have said. So in the concept of practice-based evidence, the real messy, complicated world is not controlled. Instead, real-world practice is documented and measured just as it occurs, and that's kind of my job with organizations. This allows us to answer a different, but no less important, question than does X cause Y, which is, how does adding X intervention alter the complex personalized system of patient Y before me? So these are the words of Anne K. Swisher. She's a physical therapist. She wrote these words in 2010 in an editorial introduction to the Cardiopulmonary Physical Therapy Journal. Here's another look from another field closer to us. Local aggregate evidence collected from individual client histories to learn what is actually happening in community practice. So that's Bruce Chorpita. He's a clinical psychologist at UCLA. And for me, this is kind of the bottom line, for me anyways, is that that practice-based evidence broadens what's considered credible evidence such that evidence supporting the utility, value, or worth of an intervention, program, or policy can emerge from the practices, experiences, and expertise of family members, youth, consumers, professionals, and members of the community. So those words come from the Outcomes Roundtable for Children and Families. They have a position paper out on this. Okay, so humans have this dominant frame of dichotomy, and as bipeds, this is structural, right? We've got two hands, two legs, two brain halves, two eyes, but it's also conceptual and cultural. We talk about boys, girls, black, white, red, blue, and it leads to polarization and competition. So you're with me or you're against me. You're in or you're out, you win or you lose. And the bridge metaphor activates that dominant frame of dichotomy. You've got point A and point B. And dichotomies, by their very nature, reduce complexity, right? And I want to talk about complexity. So I'm going to pull on an alternative frame of plurality, connectedness, and unity. And I'm going to create a new visual metaphor for us to illustrate how practice-based evidence is created. And hopefully the subtext that you hear here is that it's supplemental and complementary to evidence-based practice. The bridge is still in this picture. I've just kind of backed up a little bit so you can see more. I'm going to credit my inspiration here to Bernice Johnston Reagan. She gave a talk in 1981 entitled Coalition Politics, Turning the Century. This has been passed down through generations of social change activists. Part of what her talk does so well is that she draws an important distinction between the safe, home-like space that those driving change may need to bolster themselves and help define their work, which includes, researchers need that space too. and the challenging, stretching, and often uncomfortable space of coalition building, which is where social change happens on the street, right? And a thesis of her talk, in her own words, is there is nowhere you can go and only be with people who are like you. Give it up. And so here I have sort of tried to illustrate that, right? We've got the different paths now, people coming down out of the ivory tower and elsewhere via paths and footsteps and slides. But if we zoom out, we can see there's all these other places, right, and other people that are coming too. So when we start to think about partnerships and prevention programs in this context, we move away from that researcher-practitioner dichotomy, and the language of stakeholders really starts to make sense. So the ticket booth represents the entry point for many people that hold a stake in policies and programs that prevent child maltreatment. Everyone's buying their ticket for somewhat different reasons, and I might also say that the price of admission for some is different than for others, but a ticket is a ticket is a ticket, and a lot of people got them. And my prediction for the future of prevention is that as we go further and further upstream, people know that reference, right, to the root causes of child sexual abuse and maltreatment, we'll start to find more and more people interested in this issue. What we know, for example, from the ACE study, right, is that childhood trauma contributes to every leading cause of illness and death in our country. And as political and economic models evolve also, in addition to federal dollars and philanthropic foundation money, we're going to start seeing private capital invested via financial products, pay for success models or social impact bonds. So it does behoove us now to figure out how to create this big tent, forums like we're at today, that simulate this sort of place for everyone. Finally, it's important to realize that the county fair is all about the concession stand. So at the concession stand, everybody's got to pay something for sustenance, right? There's no such thing as a free corn dog. And speaking of corn dogs, you may feel a little bit uncomfortable about the standards at the concession stand. I mean, are those trucks OSHA certified? Is that meat kosher? Are those lemons organically grown? But that's the nature of the Midway, honestly. Your options are limited, they're constrained, you don't have a lot of control, and you've got to compromise and improvise. But if you think about it, at that Midway concession stand, there is nothing better than a fresh squeezed lemonade at the county fair, truly. It doesn't ever taste as good. Or if you're like my husband, you will go for the elephant ear with the sugar on it. An evaluator colleague of mine, Chris Lissy, has done this 5 cartoon blog. I'm going to only show 2 of them. It kind of points out the tension between those in the evidence-based practice camp, where randomized controlled trials are highly valued, and those who are not in that camp, which is most of the world, right? Not including this room, but out there. And I want to provide some real quotes also from folks doing this kind of work to flesh out this two-dimensional caricature. So this is from a researcher explaining the professional risks of collaborative inquiry. We stood the chance of being rejected by the practitioners because we were academics and being marginalized by our peers because we had lost objectivity. And someone from the program side says, we learned that it's one thing to be committed to social change and to youth organizing. It is another thing altogether to be committed to a learning process that is by nature long-term. We've heard about 35-year careers, right? Where mistakes are owned, beliefs challenged and sometimes changed, and flexibility and adaptability are paramount. So that's someone who participated in a 3-year evaluation learning project to result in organizational improvement. This second cartoon sort of reiterates the emerging position of practice-based evidence, which is to say it's only beginning to gain credibility. So while many of us know and value The ways that practice-based evidence is extremely useful in our day-to-day work, getting the policy and funding in place to actually systematically collect and learn from this practice-based evidence is still a pretty risky endeavor. So it's generally happening at a very small scale. It looks a lot more like these carny rides I'm about to put up at the county fair than the Millennium Force at Cedar Point. I'm actually an Ohio girl, so. I do have added in these rides to really bring home again the visceral element of this metaphor. And having been on a couple of these low budget practice-based evidence generating endeavors, I can genuinely say it's thrilling. The Ferris wheel here affords both myself and my clients unprecedented views. We're seeing things, we're learning things that don't show up in journal articles. But it also feels a little overwhelming. It's really chaotic. There's a lot of political posturing, many distractions, a lot of mediocrity, and it's noisy and sometimes stinky. And you have to be focused and determined and smart and tenacious to be productive on the midway, and these kinds of things help. And this is where I need a little help on time.
8 minutes.
Okay, so I'm gonna kind of skip through this quickly, but systems thinking can really help in continuing this dynamic midway. It's helpful to understand where you fit in the big picture, who's your closest allies, what do those allies look like, what's their missions. Here again, what stake does anybody have in your program? Is it, for example, about strengthening families or reconstructing gender norms or comprehensive sex ed, or is it crime reduction, community safety, redefining masculinity, or fatherhood or parenting? So again, figuring out what's driving those people. At that point, you can start to look for other stakeholders, which are the people with the power and the money, right? And how to connect them in, and that's not always easy. It takes different kinds of relationships to pull these folks in, but eventually, these systems become bound in formal and informal ways. And one of the ways, informally, that these systems become bound is through partnerships. So I like to think of partnerships as a very foundational structure for success in creating practice-based evidence. At its very basic level, it means two people are working together. But people overuse this term so much that I don't think anybody really knows what it means. So I'm just going to quickly give you a visual definition of kind of the levels of functioning that different partnerships can have. So you can be sharing information for the benefit of all parties, and that's a partnership. Okay, so these definitions are coming from Chris Huxham's work on collaboration. This is networking. If you add in these elements of also changing activities to achieve a stated goal, now you're coordinated. This is a partnership that's coordinating things. If we add in dividing resources, now you're at a cooperative level. And finally, and this is the end of the continuum, and I like to stress all the time that not every partnership needs to be or should or has to be or can be collaborative. But if you're going to be collaborative, what this is about is really improving the capacity of another, really knowing where someone's at and strengthening where they are for the benefit of all and to achieve a stated goal. So Roz Lasker and Elisa Weiss have done a lot of work operationalizing these ideas as synergy, which has become like another one of these really huge buzzwords. But when they came out, you know, they were really defining it and measuring it. Another way I like to think about it is as capacity building. And I'm not going to have a chance to really do this in any good way, but I at least want to put up a nice system picture for you. So the interactive systems framework basically says if we bring this back to prevention and dissemination and innovation and implementation, we need to kind of understand that there's a lot of different things going on. And collectively, three interactive systems use capacity, build capacity, and distill synthesize, and translate information for prevention. I'm going to give a shout out to Abe Wandersman and many, many colleagues he's worked with across many different sectors in developing the model I'm about to show to you. This outlays the sort of dynamic forces at play at that on this midway, right? All of these things. And again, I would argue, in addition to macro policy, and someone mentioned it earlier, this is affordable health care is a big driver, but there's also all this micro policy you've got to understand in terms of making change happen at a community level. So at the top, we have this delivery system. This has been really exciting to me today to hear about the ways that this delivery system has been. We think more innovatively about how to do this. So in my work on rape prevention, we're now, and I was going to talk a little bit about the Coaching Boys into Men curriculum. We're working with different kinds of folks. I'm working with 4-H educators in rural areas to think about them as prevention message delivery system. Working with, again, athletic coaches as delivering prevention systems, prevention messages. The second thing is the support system, and so this is places like PCAR, coalitions that kind of support the work, train the trainer models, actually some of the work that John talked about at his research agency that's helping to implement across the country. The innovations that work, a lot of important stuff going on there. And then we've got this translational system at the bottom. Let me just briefly show two places where I think that practice-based evidence is really needed. So the first place is this double-headed arrow between the support system and the delivery system. So again, we've heard a little bit about this. What makes a train-the-trainer model work? What makes what are these good relationships? How can we measure that? But also monitoring that implementation process. That second that single-headed arrow is implementation of the innovation outside of the prevention model to the real world, to outcomes that we care about, such as less child sexual abuse. So look up the model. I could have said a little bit more about it. At least here it looks clearer than my hand-drawn pictures. But let me say my last word will be on collaborative inquiry. So this is how I talk about my work now. And what is collaborative inquiry? Well, it's another sort of emerging, really fuzzy term for you to Google. But it's a way of creating learning communities that need to have someone like myself, an evaluator, facilitating the process, in which we deconstruct knowledge through joint reflection and analysis, reconstruct knowledge through collaborative action, and co-construct knowledge through collective learning from those experiences. So that's the words of Louise Stoll. Collaborative inquiry, I would just like to kind of be clear, is primarily a process to support professional learning. Since it's contextual in nature, it's not expected that findings are generalized to a larger population. So it is not truly research. This is a different kind of thing. Equally important is what I'm trying to say. So it's a process, right? It's got different phases. You frame the problem, you collect evidence, you analyze evidence, you document, celebrate, and share that evidence. And here's my call to action. Go to your local county fair this summer. Seriously, though, expand the way that you think about things. It's not a one-way street, two-way street. It's something more dynamic than that. Understand your place in that system, and ask good questions. Who's around you? How can you connect within your system? What power, leverage do you have? Who can increase your power? Whose power can you increase? And these were the little call-outs that I was giving to people that inspired the work that I'm brought to the podium today. I think if we ask these kinds of questions, and you can fill in your own question here, this is how we drive movement forward, right? What are you doing? Well, do you want to try? Why is it important? Does it make sense to you what I'm saying, what I'm doing here?
Would this be better?
What would need to change for me to participate fully too? And what can we do together that will prevent child maltreatment, including child sexual abuse, in the future? Big questions. Answers will help my kids, all your loved ones. So thank you again for this opportunity.